And good evening. It is Intuitive Soul Radio with your host, Lori Houston. Well, tonight we have a special guest, and I think you're going to really enjoy tonight. We are talking with Oriah Mountain Dreamer. We're going to talk about the name because that's also an interesting story, too. But we are actually going to start. I'm going to read the, I guess, the beginning prose poem of her first book, which I read. Okay, I don't even want to talk. I mean, it came out, what, 1999?
Yes.
And I read it then. I think I was like the first in line to pick it up or something. Everybody was kind of surprised. I had like a bunch of different books, and I had your book, and they said, oh, you're reading The Invitation. I went, I don't know who she is, but it just was drawn to me, so I'm picking it up. And they went, good for you. I had no idea you lived in Toronto. I didn't know anything about you at that point, but yeah, I'm very happy to have you here.
It's good to be here.
So we're going to talk, I'm just going to read it. It doesn't interest me what you do for a living. I want to know what you ache for. If you dare to dream of meeting your heart's longing. It doesn't interest me how old you are. I want to know if you will risk looking like a fool for love, for your dream, for the adventure of being alive. It doesn't interest me what planets are squaring your moon. I want to know if you have touched the center of your own sorrow, if you have been opened by life's betrayals, or have become shriveled and closed from fear of further pain. I want to know if you can sit with pain, mine or your own, without moving to hide it, or fade it, or fix it. I want to know if you can be with joy, mine or your own, if you can dance with wildness and let the ecstasy fill you to the tips of your fingers and toes without cautioning us to be careful, to be realistic, to remember the limitations of being human. It doesn't interest me if the story you are telling me is true. I want to know if you can disappoint another to be true to yourself, if you can bear the accusation of betrayal and not betray your own soul, if you can be faithless and therefore trustworthy. I want to know if you can see beauty, even when it's not pretty, every day, and if you can source your own life from its presence. I want to know if you can live with failure, yours and mine, and still stand on the edge of the lake and shout to the silver of the full moon, yes! It doesn't interest me to know where you live or how much money you have. I want to know if you can get up after the night of grief and despair, weary and bruised to the bone, and do what needs to be done to feed the children. It doesn't interest me who you know or how you came to be here. I want to know if you will stand in the center of the fire with me and not shrink back. It doesn't interest me where or what or with whom you've studied. I want to know what sustains you from the inside when all else falls away. I want to know if you can be alone with yourself and if you truly like the company you keep in the empty moments. And that prose seemed to have traveled the world without your even knowing it.
It has a whole little life all of its own, yes. And I didn't know how it was being spread around the world. I shared it with about 500 students who had come to work with me. And about 2 years later, I was on a computer, but it was so old it wasn't on the internet. So when I got on the internet 2 years later, I found this poem on over 200,000 websites.
Wow.
Yeah. So it had been out there doing its thing all quite apart from me.
Right. And, I mean, that was before 1999, obviously.
That's right. It was written in 1994, actually. And so it was a couple years before I even found out that it had been traveling around.
Right.
I had written a book previously called Confessions of a Spiritual Thrill Seeker, okay, which was about my apprenticeship with a shaman. And I had a lot of other writing, but I didn't know how to structure it. So finally what happened was a man who was an agent for Jean Houston, she wanted to use the poem in a book. So he got a hold of me for permission. And then he said to me, have you thought about writing a book structured on this poem? And as soon as he said it, I thought, ah, that's the structure. I have all this writing. And he became my agent, my literary
nice.
Agent. Yeah.
It's amazing how things work out like
yeah.
that. I mean, and it, you know, and that's how you start each one of your books that you've written so far, or at least the next three, that it starts with the prose and then it moves to each of the chapters to kind of take, you know, a little bit of each of those. And I think it's brilliant the way it's done. And I love that you are so authentic and you're so real. And, you know, you talk about your journey
mm-hmm.
in the books. I mean, it's very authentic. It's also very reassuring because we all seem to have our own journey. And yes, it will all be very unique to each one of us. But, you know, so many people out there are so, you know, oh, just be detached and, you know, teaching us things that really don't help us in any way on our journey. Like we sort of mentioned how so many people use The Secret as something in a book title or something because it's been selling. And, you know, The Secret did an amazing thing in that it brought a lot of people into awareness. I guess that we don't have the control maybe that The Secret is sort of telling us that we have, but we do have, we can be in charge of how we respond to situations. And I think, and I wish that that was brought into more of the movie and the book and everything.
I think she's very clear. That's not what she's saying.
Oh, no.
She's very clear. Okay. When somebody asked her if she thought the people in Rwanda who died in the genocide, the children and all the people had brought them on themselves, she said, absolutely. So I'll give her that for consistency. You know, she didn't hedge on, yes, this covers everything. You know, the Jews dreamt their own Holocaust.
Right.
She's very clear about that. The hard part is it's done so much damage.
Yeah.
I hear from people all the time who are, you know, who have clung to this kind of fundamentalist belief that I control everything. And then, of course, crap happens. Sometimes really horrible stuff. They lose a child or whatnot. And now they're responsible for that. 100%. I would say we have enormous influence on what happens. We have enormous influence on our responses, but we don't even control all of our responses. Try controlling all of your emotions. It leads to bad things, you know. So, you know, if I have enough consciousness, I can watch my emotions. This is on a good day, right? And then I can choose how I'm going to act on them or not act on them. But to say I control your emotions, what you decide to do, because, you know, you're in my environment, so obviously I must be in control of you also. It just does a lot of damage. It really does. And it's sad. I just hear from a lot of people for whom it's created more problems than anything.
Yeah. And you can see why that would happen. Because it's true. We can't ever see the big picture. We are never going to be able to, on this planet, see the bigger picture because it's not available to us.
And I get the appeal. I really do. The appeal is, it says, it's what happens every time something bad happens. And, you know, somebody gets cancer, somebody loses a child. I actually heard somebody the other day say to somebody with cancer, well, I guess you needed this. Yeah. But after my initial, people are afraid. People are really, you know, life is scary. The unexpected is going to happen and there's going to be loss and you're not going to be able to predict where or when. So a kind of rule, whatever your rule is about what makes that happen, is to reassure the frightened heart that this can't happen to me. So I look at you or somebody else and I say, well, that happened to you because of this, and I would never allow that, so it can't happen to me. Mm-hmm. It's a false sense of security, of course, because we're all going to die. Mm-hmm. And the odds are between now and then, there's going to be other losses in our life. So it's, you can't make enough rules. But, you know, we all have our inner fundamentalist that would like to have a rule that says, this will keep me safe.
Yeah. Yeah. So we're going to talk mostly about the call, but I do want to bring up a few points in the dance. Because when I read the dance, I actually read it last, of course. I don't know why. It brought up something about surrender that I hadn't really, and it's in the call, it's still there, but until I read it, maybe I just needed to read it a few more times, I got it. Like, I really, because I think in the call you talk about, you know, let it be. Mm-hmm. I still didn't get that. But when I, in the dance, and I'm going to bring, you know, it's you really go into, you know, it doesn't matter what you do or how you do it. It's, you know, it's how you do whatever you choose to do. So it's your choices that you're making. It's so when we're, you know, looking at these situations that we don't like in our life, and we're thinking, you know, what can I do to fix this? Like, what can I do? My God, I got to do something. you know, it's that surrender is really about accepting it, but not just accepting it, but just saying it, you know, it's there. You know, what choices are you going to make now around that?
Yes. Which might mean that you make choices that change whatever the thing is, right?
Sure.
I mean, I'm not sort of, I've lately been disturbed. I mean, I try as much as possible to go to a place of kind of, you know, what is what is. That's what I've got to work with. Internally, externally, this is the start point. But I hear people translate that as what is what should be.
Oh, yes.
And I always think, first of all, why? Why put should in there at all? I mean, you know, children are being abused and raped. That's not as it should be.
Mm.
And if I'm in a position at any point in my life to do something to prevent that or to help with the healing from that, that's my choice to do that. But the other piece of the dance is about, even if I choose to do that, what matters most is how I do it. So if I do it from a place where I am frenetically hoping that somehow I will save the whole world, then you do what Wayne Mueller calls doing good badly.
Yes.
Right? And you and I were both trained as social workers.
Yes.
I once spoke to the graduating class of the Kansas State University social work class, and I said, I introduced myself as a recovering social worker. Because, and it's no surprise, when I worked in an agency, we one time did a birth order count, and 90% of us who worked there were first children. Right.
Oh.
So that's an amazing sense of responsibility for others, for the world. And I don't think that's all bad at all. That real desire to make a difference, you know. But we have to deal with whatever wounded part of us might also be behind that, or we will end up doing good badly, and that often can do more harm than good. So there's the how is always like, where does it sit with me? Where is it coming from in me? And it doesn't preclude taking action. And watching, of course, what happens inside you as you take action. Because you might not be doing it for the reasons you think. And that might not be clear until you're halfway through. And you're dragging some poor person you want to save through a process they don't want to go through.
You know, haven't we all done that?
I actually wrote a line once that was very much for me about some of that shadow side of the social worker, which was... if you would just let me save your life, perhaps it would not hurt so much to know I cannot save my own.
Mm.
And I think that's the shadow side that you have to sit with and what that's about if you're going to do good well.
Mm-hmm. And there's so much with regards to how we try to, you know, it's really about us trying to get people to love us and accept us for who we are. And so we do all of these very strange things that we think, you know, if we can change somebody else or save somebody else, and, well, then they'll love us because, you know, we're such a good person, right?
Yeah.
and we're really a lot of times very unconscious of the ways and the reasons we're doing it.
Yeah, because that usually covers a tremendous sense of, or some sense of feeling like who we are is not enough. We need to earn our way. We need to earn the right to take up space and breathe. When in fact, that's not true.
Yeah.
You know, who you are just by being is what is wanted and needed right here, right now.
Yeah.
And if we knew that, it doesn't stop us from acting, being an active participant in shaping the world. It just means it unhooks us from a driven sense of needing to earn every moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the other part of the surrender that I love, because it's, you know, that bit, are you enough? I mean, you are enough, but we don't think we are because everything's been so conditional.
Yeah.
It's amazing. The other part that I loved about the dance is, you know, are you willing to be happy? Not how would you be willing, you know, but that you know, that it's about what are the things, the surrender thing again, the acceptance. And that's, you know, all the things that we like suffering. I mean, there's a part of us that
it's familiar.
Yeah.
We
need it.
We know how to handle that. And if we're trying to earn something, We tend to think it's part of that. I mean, the other thing about that, you know, are you willing to be happy, is if you don't get your way, if you're not declared as right, you know, I mean, it's an old thing about, you know, are you willing, do you want to be right or do you want to be happy? And of course, the young part of us goes, I'll be happy when you admit I'm right.
Yeah, exactly.
And that really lets our happiness rest in the hands of someone who may or may not agree with us. Why would we do that, you know?
Right. Yeah. It's true. It's so true. Yes, it's so true. It's so sad.
Yeah, and so hard to untangle it sometimes, you know? Because things do matter to us sometimes. They really do, you know? And we want things to be whatever it is we want. We want them to be more just or easier or, you know, one of the things I've had to ask, because I have chronic fatigue and I have for 27 years, and there's been periods where that's been acute and periods when it's been more manageable. But, you know, am I willing to be happy with chronic fatigue?
Yeah, accepting it for...
I mean, at this point, I could say yes. You know, that I have a tremendous faith that what's most important to my heart and soul can be lived in a life with the particular limitations that I have. That none of what matters most is sacrificed. But that's after 27 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've been talking about it on Facebook a little bit. And, you know, you hear from people who've had it for a year or whatnot. And quite understandably, they're just mortified at the idea that you would even ask the question. They don't want to even consider the possibility that they're going to have to endure a long-term chronic illness. Yeah. And I get that 100%.
And the bit about being right. I mean, I know it's an ego game. And I love what you talk about in the call about bringing the ego and our essence together, because that's so important. Because these people that say that they don't, you know, get rid of their ego, it makes me just want to cry.
Yeah.
Because there's pieces, I think, that, you know, I think they get pieces that they're not really explaining to us at all.
Yeah.
And we're left trying to understand their pieces that don't really get explained to us.
Exactly.
And we're like... so lost.
It's one of the things I really appreciate about the Jungians, is they don't demonize the ego.
Right.
They don't mistake it for the essential self, but they're also really aware that the kind of transformation most people in a spiritual community are talking about can only happen if you have a strong enough ego not to scatter, not to just shatter to a million pieces and not be reassembled. And it's that, you know, we mistake the ego's agenda for what should drive all our decisions. And,
right.
You know, and the ego wants safety, and it wants the illusion of sovereignty over its own world. In fact, something like Secret really appeals to the ego, because it's saying, I've called it ego idolatry, right? Because it's saying, I, and when you say it like that, it's got to be the little I. I am in charge of everything.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Thank goodness that's not true.
Yeah.
What a mess we would be in.
I'm always amazed at how many people, though, still have it in their consciousness that that's the way it is, you know, law of attraction. These are the way things work. I mean, these are it. I obviously, you know, there's, you know, some part of their belief and faith that works for them. And I don't understand the rest of it. Like, it's like these people that I don't want to even put it down there, but, you know, that say, oh, I found my perfect soulmate. And, you know, soulmates to me are not, I mean, they're wonderful. But there's so much work. I mean,
right.
That's what they're there for. They're to help us grow spiritually, or else our souls wouldn't be attracted to them. I mean, their work.
Yeah.
You know, when they say, oh, it's just so wonderful, and they go on and on and on, I'm thinking, really? Like, what world do you live in?
Well, they're living in the early stage there. It's funny, you know, because the Imago therapists will talk about it. When they do brain scans of people in that wonderful, euphoric, falling in love stage, their brain scans are similar to heroin addicts on heroin. So it's probably not the best time to make major life decisions. It is lovely. It's ecstatic. It's wonderful. You know, who would not want to have that come into their life at various times? But it's not where we live most of the time and still manage to function. It's lovely. But
and then I think there are the people, though, that are actually, and I don't want to put them down, but, you know, that believe, or they pretend that is really how they're living their entire life.
Right. Okay. So what you're talking about is denial.
Yeah.
Right? Major denial, which is kind of the same thing as wanting to be right. I mean, there's a whole, right? Recently, I talked to a friend who knows Mark Epstein, who's a wonderful writer. He wrote, book about desire. That's just great. That's slipped my mind. But he's a psychiatrist in New York City and a Buddhist. And they were talking about denial because my friend was saying, he was talking about how all the members of his family were in denial, except for him.
Of course, yes.
And I mean, this is one of the kind of bad habits in the spiritual community and the psychotherapeutic community is that, and it's true, we can see other people's blindness brilliantly as they can see ours. And so we get really quick to label other people as being in denial. It's not that it's untrue. It's just not particularly helpful. So Mark Epstein says to my friend, you know, I like to think of denial as a place where we're caught in an old sorrow. Mm. And that has a very different feel to it. You know, I just wrote a little bit about this on the blog because I realized I'm still in denial about not being able to go out in the evening. I really can't go out after 6 in the evening with the chronic fatigue. Mm. Or I mean, I can, obviously, and I do. But then I tend to be flat on my back for 3 or 4 days or more.
Yeah.
So I can't write another book and go out in the evening. Right. And I've been in denial about this because I really don't want to give up doing any social with my friends who are still gainfully employed in the daytime. So I started lying there and thinking about Mark's words and thinking, so where am I caught in an old sorrow around this? And I went into this sort of, dropped into this memory in my body of being in high school and truly being out of sync. I grew up in a small town in northern Ontario, New Liskeard, and I was a strange girl. You know, I was continually asking questions about God and ethics and prayer and all this stuff. I was not a hot date or a party asset in any way, shape, or form in high school. But I still wanted to belong. I wanted to be included, and I couldn't stop pursuing these things. So that sense of isolation and not belonging. And then I come to Toronto in a much larger community. I find many people who are interested in these questions, right? And so part of being in denial is that old sorrow of feeling of isolation and separation and not wanting to go, imagining that I would go back there. And of course, I'm not going to go back there. I'm a different than when I was 16. And but that was under my denial. So right. I think it's, you know, we all have old sorrows, and that's where we go into denial. That's where we go blind, because the pain of that is so great, we just don't want to get near it.
It's, you know, it's amazing. I mean, we are all so incredibly unique, and we all have, you know, these stories that brought us into this life that really probably are the gifts that give us strength and to push us and to, you know, make us who we are now. But those griefs, those pains, you know, to touch on some of them, I mean, and that's what you talked about in the invitation. I mean, right. it really takes a lot to have the courage and strength to do that.
And it doesn't mean that the pain wasn't real. No. It also doesn't mean that something or someone orchestrated that pain. You know, when I was a young woman, I was raped. And when much later in my life I worked with women who had been raped, it was part of what I could offer them was knowing what that was like.
Right.
And that was very helpful to them. I mean, there are some experiences in life. I think probably losing a child is like this. You know, rape and violence, where there's a point at which you really need to talk to somebody who actually knows what that's like from the inside. I wouldn't say that's why the rape happened. Right? No, people say that. Well, everything happens for a reason. And now look at how you're able to, you know, that's what part of the meaning I made of it. Viktor Frankl, you know, was in Auschwitz, said, don't ask why did this happen, ask what meaning will I make of this. And not to confuse the two, not to say, you know, because I used it that way, that some divine power, which I quite frankly would not be interested in if it was orchestrating rape so there'd be somebody to counsel rape victims. Seriously.
Yeah, no.
You know, that's not a plan. So I part of it is living with not knowing. Yeah. Why something happens. You know, we can look at what responsibility, if any, we had in a situation. Sometimes we do, sometimes we don't. But we have to live to some degree with not knowing.
Yeah.
And not superimpose that kind of reason on top of it.
Yeah. Because we all want to understand absolutely everything. And that's our ego that's trying to
get control because life is scary.
Right.
Life is scary.
It is.
And we do have an inflated sense in this culture of control, because look at all we've done technologically and all the rest of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
I once heard the Dalai Lama being interviewed, where he said they were talking about regrets, and he said he had regrets, and the interviewer was amazed, and he said, I regret that I wasn't there for the death of my brother. And the guy said, well, what did you do with that? And Dalai Lama looked sort of puzzled and said, I live with that. Right? He was okay with, that's a regret. And that's what, you know, it wasn't crippling him.
Right.
But neither was it resolvable. He didn't expect that to be healed and disappear. That's right. You know, if he could have done it over and found a way to be there, he would have done that. But that's not how life works.
Yeah. Okay. So the call is really about this place in our heart, that thing that moves us, that really
won't let us go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, you've worked with physical elders,
mm-hmm.
as well as you have a group of non-physical elders.
Yes.
And they're all in your dreams?
Yes.
So not in meditation?
Oh, no. They can come in meditation also, wake or sleep, but they do come... In some ways, I almost trust some of what happens more in the sleep dream, because, of course, my conscious mind's not trying to control it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And that's amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, some people would say that's, you know, well, we know what some people would say. But, I mean, that's amazing, because I've never had that experience in my dreams. And that's where you got at least Oriah.
Yes.
Mountain Dreamer came from physical elders.
Yes, from a man that I apprenticed with, actually. He gave me the medicine name Mountain Dreamer the first time he met me, actually.
Oh, wow.
And told me it meant someone who likes to find and push the edge. And my understanding of that over time has changed. You know, at the time, I was dealing with the beginning of the illness. I'd really gone to him for healing. And I would have said at that point, and when would I have been about 30 at that point, that pushing the edge was, you know, kind of bravely doing more. And everybody's edge looks different.
Right?
Sometimes doing less is somebody's edge. Sometimes sitting still is really somebody's edge, not doing something wild. Sometimes, you know, washing dishes and bringing your full attention to it is somebody's edge.
Right. That's really hard to do.
Yeah. Yeah. No, we'd love it to be grander. Definitely. Can't it be grander than that? My edge can't be doing dishes consciously. Please.
So it's about, the call is sort of guiding us to understand how you can live the longing, the wanting of God. I mean,
mm-hmm.
talk about that. I mean, for you at the end, you sort of came up with, you know, there's a word that we come up, and I think that's amazing. But that longing that we have in that, how did you word that? God mad. God mad.
Yeah. It's funny. Somebody one time at the end of a presentation I did in a crowd, I don't remember where I was, got up and said, what's most important to you? What's the thing that you long for most? And I think it was more what's more important to you, because afterwards they talked to me about, and I didn't pause. I said, God. And that's always been true. And somebody came up to me later and said, oh, that would be true for me, but I would have felt that I should say family first, and, you know,
right.
this kind of thing. And I said, well, you know, I know God and love God often through the people I'm with. But that sense of the wholeness that's larger, you know, as Buber says, God is an overburdened word in our culture, unfortunately.
Yes.
And I tend to say mystery more, the great mystery, just to remind myself that we don't really know what we're talking about exactly. We're pointing towards something larger and a whole that's both within me and within which, and I'm within it.
Right.
But it's also a whole that's greater than the sum of the parts. So I would agree with people who say, you know, the divine is within us. I think that's true. But that doesn't make me all of God.
No.
That's fairly important to distinguish between. You know, there's a lot of other things going on here. So, but it was always true for me that longing was there, to know that presence. And it's only been more recently in my life where I went through a period where I couldn't feel that presence. That had never happened to me before. And it was terrifying. And yet, I'd have to say, it gave me great insight to working with people where of course, you know, I'm coming with this experience from the majority of my life of feeling this presence, but I may be talking to somebody who says, I want that, but I don't know what you're talking about. I've never felt it, right? And sort of experiencing that sense of, it's like being suspended mid-air kind of thing, you know, with nothing around you. It's terrifying, truly. Yeah.
To have it lost or to...
To have it lost, yeah. Yes. I mean, you know, thank God, literally, that, you know, I mean, what I would say happened was, which is what always happens, because God, whatever you think that is, the mystery doesn't go anywhere. I went somewhere. And I got so disconnected from myself and from a deep knowing in myself that really blocked my knowledge of that presence. And it was not good. It was not a happy place.
Yeah, I'm thinking of, you know, what God means and how we, you know, well, I mean, it's dogmatized and everything.
Yeah.
I mean, that part of it is not, but the aspect where we, you know, it's that peace within us that sort of, does it pull on us? Does it? I mean, it's for some, you know, they may not say God, but
right.
Everybody knows home. Like
right.
Everybody knows that searching. Is it?
Yes.
I mean, we are searching for that home.
Yes. Yeah. And I don't think it matters what word you use.
Yeah.
Some people get upset when I say that, but I really don't think it does. And I'm pretty sure that whatever it is not too worried about what word we're using. But yes, I think home is probably a more neutral word for people, in the sense of it's not overburdened by years of religious dogma and whatnot, you know.
Yeah.
You know it when you feel it, when you taste it, when you're sitting in the middle of it. You can't make it happen, but you can be willing. I mean, it is grace. Grace is unearned blessings. And, you know, in a culture where we earn so much, to know there's something that, one, we deserve as a birthright, and two, we can't earn it. We can sit, we can open. But the beloved, the mystery that is the beloved, searches for us also, is always looking for a way in. What always surprises me is when we're in a place where we don't feel that connection, it feels so bleak, and it doesn't feel like there's anything we can do. We're not sure how to turn our face just, you know, an eighth of an inch, so that can find us again. And that's all it takes, but it feels like 1,000 miles, not an eighth of an inch, when you're in that place. So my sense is that presence is always there looking for a way in, and sometimes we're just so caught in pain and so disconnected from our essential being that we can't make that quarter inch turn right then. The minute we can... And sometimes we borrow somebody else's faith.
Yeah.
We lean on somebody else's faith, and they help us turn that little eighth of an inch, and there it is.
And leaning on someone else's faith is great. It's
absolutely.
The ones that, you know, try and tell you that they're the only way. That's a bit of a...
Yeah, that's always a bit of a tip-off.
Yeah.
Any kind of only way. And it's, you know, we're all familiar with that with traditional religions, but I hear it a lot with different New Age methodologies. You know, somebody was just telling me about how she talked to this guy who ran through all the other methodologies and why they were lacking and why his way was the only way. He's lost me instantly.
Yeah, it's funny because I think we all have, you know, it's kind of like your word theory. I think we all have this peace,
mm-hmm.
and it may be the peace for us. I mean, it.
Yeah.
You know, it may very well be our piece to achieving what we want.
Right.
It doesn't necessarily mean that every other piece is still needed.
Right, right. And it may be our piece for now.
Yes.
That's the other thing, right?
Yeah.
It's like, it's constant change. So it, you know, might not be our piece in 10 years. It may,
right.
That may change.
Yeah.
And that can be disheartening for people.
It's well, like, it's like you finally think you got somewhere,
yeah,
right? And then
yeah.
It's like, oh, crap, I know it's all changing. Well, what's going on now?
Yes. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So one of the things you learned in the call is, you know, that we're always doing. We're always trying to mm-hmm. do something. And it's in the not doing that you discovered.
Right. And the not doing is, you know, people think, well, what does that mean? I'm just sitting here staring at the wall, you know, kind of thing.
Of course you are, right? I mean, that's all you did, right?
And the not doing has most to do with letting go of our tremendous commitment to achieving a certain outcome. You know, which, you know, Buddhists would talk about as a lack of attachment, which gets confused with detachment, yes, which is not the same thing at all, you know. But it's an interesting question to ask yourself, whatever you're doing in your life, is to think about where you think it's going to lead. You know, you do a certain kind of work because you hope it will help people, or you hope it will make the world a better place, or you need to make a living, all reasonable things. And part
or
of
even
the,
just to help you.
Right.
You know, sometimes you just do things to help you.
Right. And sometimes things, you know, people have to be fed, people need to be clothed,
yes,
all that's great.
Oh, yes.
But for the bigger things that we get attached to, you know, the kind of our smaller versions of saving the world, the question is, would I do this? Like when I write a book, I think to myself, and if, especially if it gets difficult at some point, will I do this if there's only one person that it will actually have any real meaning for? Mm. And now writing's easier for me because I really write for the one for myself, for what I learn. But there are other things, you know, you have to sort of pause and go, would I do this without knowing the outcome? Because that actually is the reality. We don't know the outcome. Well, in both ways, like some things we do, we think are insignificant, can have a tremendous ripple effect, you know, and other things we think are going to change the world, not so much. Yeah. Right. So it's more about, is the quality of the experience I'm having enough in and of itself? Or would I prefer just to walk away from this? And I'm not saying this is simple, because we do things. You know, I just as I say that, I think I when the invitation came out, and I was leading a retreat at one point, and my publicist called the retreat center to say Oprah's producer wanted to talk to me. So I finished the retreat, and I was exhausted, and I was driving in Northern Ontario in the middle of the bush, and I stopped at a payphone to call Oprah's producer, who's a very young woman. On the phone, who's talking about 800 miles an hour, right? And she says to me, and this is just the way they do it, and she's typing at the same time, and she says, can you tell me what the book is about in one sentence or less? So I said, it's about slowing down. And she said, okay, great, got that. What's next? And I had this moment of just picturing the phone dangling in the phone booth and me was walking away because I was in such a totally different place than where she was, right?
Yeah.
But it had to do with feeding the children, you know, that I had an obligation to other people, to my dear, sweet publicist who had finally managed to set this up. This is like the holy grail of publicists.
Yes.
You know, and to the people who had worked with me, because nobody puts a book out alone, you know. There were all kinds of people, editors, publisher, you know, you name it together. So I just, you know, hung in there and kept talking, and that was fine. And so it's not that every moment has to be the height of pleasure or that we don't do some things. And it wasn't that this was unpleasant. It was just so out of sync with where I was at the time. And we were in, like, we could have been on different planets, literally. You know, she's in Chicago in this high-powered, fast office building, and I'm in the middle of the bush on a highway with logging trucks passing me, you know?
Yeah.
So it's somehow just taking a deep breath and doing what needs to be done, but also asking ourselves if it's being done only for the goal. If that goal is uncertain, would we still do what we're doing?
Yeah.
Right.
And how do we can never know because we never really truly can get the bigger picture.
Right. You know, a little bit in hindsight sometimes, right? Like I have this image all the time I use about just find the next white pebble that shows you which way to go through the dark woods because you only get them one at a time, right? If you turn around, sometimes you can see how the pebbles made a pattern of in the path that you followed, but you only get a glimpse of that in hindsight. You don't really get it ahead of you.
Yeah. No. Yeah. That's my issue about why I call myself an intuitive and not a psychic.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I just see it as, you know, you handing over your power to somebody in front of you that's, you know, telling you what your life is and then people need that. It's
right.
Like they so there's so many of us that just so want somebody to tell us what to do.
Because,
tell me what to do.
Yeah, because the future is unpredictable and uncertain, and we know there's going to be loss. So we want to see it coming. We think it won't hurt as much if we could. You know, I've had a lot of precognitive dreams in my life, and I'm always curious about what I'm supposed to do with them. Because they're usually for other people. I don't trust the ones for myself quite as much. And most of the time, I don't do anything with them. Because I think of it as I'm seeing one of a number of possible futures. And unless, quite frankly, those grandmothers in my dream, and this has happened, where they've said to me, tell this person about this, where there's usually been a risk factor, something they're going to miss that puts them in danger. And I hate doing this because I think, oh, great, they don't know me. I'm going to call them up. Or, you know, or maybe we've met once. And then usually the grandmothers will say to me, and how are you going to feel if this, if she misses this and bad things happen? That you're willing to trade for your self-preservation here, you know, of not looking silly. So, you know, In that case, I do share it. And I, with a million riders, you know, on it, like, who knows, you know, kind of thing. But it has been helpful sometimes to people.
Right.
But usually I'm very cautious with it. Very cautious.
Yeah. Well, it's true. And I always say that too. It's like, I'm telling you what the energy telling me right now.
That's right.
And you know what? Once you know what the energy is telling you right now, you can change that. I mean, it can be like 2 seconds later, it can completely shift.
Infinite possibilities.
Totally.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's the thing about choices, and that's the thing about acceptance, that, you know, and surrender. I mean, just knowing that, you know, everything can change in a second.
Absolutely.
Like, no matter how down you feel, and, you know, everything can change in a second.
What amazes me is when my internal state changes completely and nothing external changes.
Yeah.
That I love. I always go, okay. You know, I go from being ecstatically happy to wretchedly worried, or vice versa. And I think, now, has anything actually changed in the world?
Right.
No. But I've managed to get myself into or out of some kind of internal mess.
Right.
So I always find that fascinating. It's like, nothing has actually happened yet. Now, things do happen that can change everything immediately also.
Yeah.
But it's always intriguing to me to just watch how much of that happens internally.
It is interesting. So you talk a lot about, you know, the stories that we have and how everybody is so unique, which is true. And it's really about, you know, the bit about fighting the war, I think that that's a really interesting thing, because it's like, and I don't know if it's necessarily our ego or what it is, but, you know, that desire, that need, it's like a ache to fight the war, like to get in and change
And it's got to be mixed with, I mean, there's the light side of that, which is, you know, you see something, and I mean, I wish in some ways we collectively more stood up about, you know, certain environmental things, abuses of people, and just said, that's it. Like, this is where the line is drawn. You walk over that line, we're going to stop you from doing this. Grandfather, one of the guides in my dreams one time said to me, it amazes me how willing you are to take responsibility for things over which you have no control, and how eager you are to abdicate responsibility for things that are really up to you, right? Like, we get this really switched around. So we'll, you know, be railing on about something, you know, somebody the other day was talking about the corporate food stuff, right? Which in that moment she really couldn't do anything about. But we'll expend an enormous amount of energy like that. And I'm not saying we shouldn't do something about it. If we can, we should do it.
Yeah.
But it's more, we waste a lot of energy on this. Yeah. And sometimes, and I'm very curious about that. I'm curious about how we throw away energy. And then we are, as a culture, chronically fatigued, you know, people running around. And I think, yeah, but, you know, we throw away energy all over the place. And I wonder if we're afraid of what we would do if we didn't throw away energy. What kind of responsibility we'd really have if we had the energy to do what we could do.
If we shone that power that we are
to
the world as a true beacon that it is, and not be afraid of it.
Yeah. It takes a lot of energy, for instance, to go into denial.
Yeah.
To keep, you know, to always be positive.
Resistance.
To look up, 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 no matter what's going on. I mean, oh my gosh, I'm just tired saying it, you know? So there's a lot of, we, you know, in this whole sustainable energy system, we're not, you know, individually, we don't necessarily do so well with that. That's not a sustainable way to live. And sooner or later, you find yourself on your bathroom floor crying, you know, and then you fix yourself and you go up and you're up, up, up kind of thing. I once did a talk for ministers of the religious science group in the United States. Lovely people, but people who also felt tremendous responsibility to present nothing but the positive to congregants, right? And I thought to myself, this is great. We're all here together without their congregants. So let's talk about what they do with their despair. This is kind of funny because I'm backstage and they have people who do kind of warm-up acts who are some of the ministers, and people vie for this. They're like three-minute presentations, but they're like cheerleading presentations. I kid you not. So one person is out there with a clown costume on, and there's cheerleading with the crowd. And I'm backstage with my despair talk, hearing this, thinking, oh, dear, we're not going to be starting from the same place. But it's too late now. And, you know, I went out, and I started to talk about this, and I was ready for anything to happen. I was ready for people to leave, be upset, you know. And that's not what happened, of course. People started to weep. All these uncried tears from people who feel like they have, their job is to prevent nothing but the positive, right? And we had a wonderful conversation about where all that other stuff is going. And there were quite a number of spouses of ministers there who came up afterwards and thanked me. Because, of course, they're seeing the real human struggle. And I don't think we do a service to those who we have any helping capacity with to pretend that you're going to get to a place where it's all going to be positive. Yeah. How is that possible? Life is impermanent, you know. If you love, you will lose. Yeah. That's just part of life.
Yeah.
And it will be sad. Maybe a little sad, maybe hugely sad, but there will be some sadness.
Yeah. So we talked a little bit about the ego and the essence. I mean, it really is the critical piece of how we live this world. I mean, we can't live fully if we're trying to stifle one and just focus on the other.
No, neither way, actually. If you live just in the ego, you're like a ping pong ball being batted around by the conditions around you. One moment elation, next moment, you know, crisis, you know. And there are days. We all have days like that where we are the ping pong ball. We are not the paddle. We are the ball. So this connection to the essence that is this kind of original goodness, that is this compassionate nature that knows that you are another myself. Now, one of the pluses that ego brings to that container-wise is that even as I know you're another myself, I know that you are wholly other. That you know, there's a place where what's me stops and you begin, and your experience is going to be different than mine. So we have this kind of strange paradox, and it's not to resolve that, but to hold the tension of that, of those two things. Knowing that you're wholly other, knowing that you're another myself.
Right.
And to hold that. So I talk about the ego as kind of giving the shape to our lives, right? I mean, I'm a writer. I could be lots of other things. I have been lots of other things. But with my personal preferences and talents and limitations and whatnot, that's the shape that is best for me at this time. But the essence is still there, is still the same. Because there may very well be a day when I'm no longer a writer, and that essence stays the same. Somebody asked me on a thread yesterday, who would Araya be without having ME, myalgic encephalomyelitis, which is the real word for chronic fatigue? And I said, that's easy. I'd be the same person. I'd be the same being that I am, although the shape of my life would look different, probably, right? So it's sort of both of those at the same time. And we swing a little. We always swing at least a little,
right,
back and forth.
Well, I did an interview with a lama who had who was the seventh lineage of the Bon tradition.
Yes.
And you know, I asked him. I said, do you have memories of the seven lives?
Yes.
And his response was that he has the memories of the compassion. He has the memories of the essence. He doesn't have the memories of the personality.
That's a great answer, isn't it? Because here in the West, we would get completely preoccupied yes. with, so who exactly were you? What gender were you? What job did you do? You know, where, what were your circumstances? We would get very caught up in all of those details. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So and that's not the piece that needs to be carried forward, apparently.
Exactly. Exactly.
Now, but think about the logical conclusion of that. And this is why people find this hard. People say to me, what do you think happens after we die? And quite frankly, I don't think about it much. It doesn't really concern me. But on a kind of, you know, logical level, I think two things. One is it's unlikely to me that the energy that I am would suddenly disappear. Energy doesn't disappear. It transforms. So it becomes something. On the other hand, I doubt very much of all the things that I, in my everyday reality, label Araya would continue. It doesn't make sense to me. It just doesn't make sense. Having said that, you know, the whole field theory and Lynn Mintaggart stuff about how whatever's put into the field stays would explain how, even if that doesn't happen quite the way we like to think of it, there is still something that has been Araya that remains in that field, which I think is why when I do something, I've done ceremonies, say funeral pipes, where the spirit of someone who has passed will talk to a loved one. So, I mean, so I have these two very different experiences, yeah. right? Where I think, okay, so what is it that's talking to me? And they will give me details often that the person I could not possibly have known. They'll say, remember the day we were in Central Park in New York? Well, I'm not, you know, that's not, but where am I getting that from, you know, and who is that? What is that? And I don't really know. I mean, it's part of sort of the mystery. But I don't get too worried about, exactly what happens. But I think that's part of the reason why people like the past life stuff and the details of the past life stuff, because it feels like a reassurance that what I'm, you know, and I'm fairly attached to the body I have, etc., you know, that will somehow, that identity will continue. If it does, I doubt if it's as important to me, and I'm not saying it shouldn't be important here in this life.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and there's a lot of teachers out there that, of course, that talk about, you know, well, we're all one, and they have this, you know, this, and we are all one.
Well, although I love Jeff Brown's reply to that always, which is, one what? I think we all participate in the same wholeness. Yes. I really do.
And that's that essence. Yeah. That's that compassion. Yes. That's that peace that you can see in everybody, even though you can't always see it.
Yes.
Even every once in a while, you can yes. see it in everybody.
Yeah.
But it's you know, I mean, there's so many people. And I just, there was somebody that was doing a, you know, I was at interviewing, and, you know, she was going on about it. And she said, like, she wasn't understanding a piece. And I said, well, couldn't it just be our souls? Because our souls also have memories. They're not, you right. know, they're sort of storing the memories of everything that we've sort of done from all our lives. She went, oh, that's it. It's like, okay, well, that's not really, you know, like, I mean, I don't know where you think you're going, because clearly she thinks she's going into oneness and,
right.
you know, everything is one and she can see everybody as one. It's like, but we really do have individuated aspects of ourselves. I
right.
mean, there's this personality that is us.
That's right.
That is, and really unique.
In fact, our task is, I really do think, to individuate completely in according to what our soul's agenda is, our deepest sense of our own calling, whether or not you call it the soul or you call it something else. I mean, the truth is that all these terms and then the various stories we have around it, you know, like my soul goes on to oneness or my soul goes on to another life, mostly we're claiming to know things we can't know. We just can't know.
Yeah.
So we believe them if they're helpful to us. I try to believe as little as possible. I try to expand my capacity to stay with, I don't know. That's an interesting story. Some parts of that make sense to me. Some parts don't. But we're continually claiming to know stuff we don't know.
Yeah.
Which, honestly, if somebody does it for themselves, particularly in a difficult time. Like if somebody mm-hmm. says to me, I had this horrible thing happen to me, you know, I lost a child, I was violated in some way, and I understand this to be because of this reason and this teaching, I am not going to quibble with them. Mm-hmm. Quite frankly, if that's what gets you out of bed in the morning after something like that, great. the problem is when they then say to another person who's had that happen, and so I know that's why what that happened to you, right?
Right.
I mean, we're claiming something at times to know something about our own lives that we can't even know, let alone about somebody else's life. But we do like to turn our personal survival strategies into larger, grander schemes for everyone.
Yes, like it. Yes, yes, yes. It's we've done this so that we can heal the rest of the world.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We had to. I had to go through my abandonment so that I could heal everybody's abandonment.
Yeah.
I've had people tell me that. Like seriously, I'm not thinking necessarily that it's going to have helped everybody else in the world, because I think seriously everybody.
Yes,
it's
working
through that's separation,
right.
And
yes,
abandonment.
Abandonment and overwhelmment, the two biggies. Eh?
Yeah.
Yeah. I am small, the world is large and a scary place.
Yeah.
So then you go, you know, you have to deal with I'll be abandoned or I'll be overwhelmed. I mean, these are just, that's what the human psyche deals with, right? And how we deal with that. You know, I love the work of James Hollis, who's a Jungian analyst, and he's very big on in the second half of life, we have to grow up. And what that means is we have to learn to tolerate anxiety, ambiguity, and ambivalence. Mm. And most of these schemes, most of the belief systems that we try to put in place are to try and lower anxiety, ambivalence, and ambiguity. And so if we're really going to live fully who we are, as messy as that is, we're going to have to tolerate the anxiety that goes along with not knowing what will happen next, the unpredictability of life, right?
Yeah.
Now, this is a hard sell. You know, come work with me and you'll learn to tolerate more anxiety. That's not really what most people are looking for.
Let me show you how you can grieve. Really, really grieve.
Yeah.
Heart-wrenching. On the floor, grief. It will feel so good.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you are a delight. We've touched on a lot of things. I think that there is so much more we could touch on. So let's end it with the word part, because I think it's an interesting piece of the weaving that we have to do. And I do like how... Go ahead.
So what I suggest, and I do suggest this as a kind of an exercise, not as the truth, right? I say this because, of course, people, even though I say this and I say, please don't do this, people do it immediately. So, but I suggest that you just consider, what if there's like one word that you're here to embody and say. And it's not a big word, okay? So it's not truth, love, gratitude. It's not the big ones. It's a little word. It's a small human word, you know? Let's assume that we're all here in one way or another to embody parts of truth and love and all that good stuff. Joy, faith, the big ones, okay? But again, in essence, taking a particular form, I'm here also for my own journey, but also as my little thread in the whole tapestry we're weaving together to try and embody a kind of word that is core to me. This is a kind of, you know, around the power of word also in the beginning is the word kind of thing. What might that be? What's the thing that you can't do well, that you keep trying to do? Because it's not what you do well. And one of the reasons for that is we don't teach best what we do well. You know, from the time I was very young, I could leave my body. I could send my awareness out. I could verify I'd gone somewhere, all the rest of it. When somebody asked me to teach an out-of-body class, I had no idea what to say. It was like, you just leave your body, right? Because that came naturally to me. Mm-hmm. So we teach best things that we had to learn and struggle with, because we tend to then get the minute steps. So it's something that you keep falling down around every time. And you keep learning, and you do learn. It's not that you're not learning anything, but you have to be conscious about it. It doesn't happen unconscious. I can unconsciously leave my body. I can consciously leave my body. For me, the word is rest.
Mm-hmm.
I find it very difficult to come to, much less than I used to, I will say, I'm getting a little, I have learned something, but to come to a place of really deep rest on every level of being, right? And I have chronic fatigue.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Oh, perfect. Yes. And no, That's not why I got chronic fatigue, no. Because I know lots of people who can't rest who don't have chronic fatigue. So, however, it does mean that when I, to the degree I can't rest, the repercussions for me are huge. Like, I don't just, you know, have a down day. I can end up on flat on my back for weeks. So the incentive to learn this is pretty high. So I often say to people, you know, the people who love you can tell you what it is you can't get. And I also always say, now don't go tell people you love what their word is. If they ask you, okay, because, you know, it's like the denial thing. It's like, oh, I know what her word is. Yes. No, not helpful. So, but it's a way of sort of saying, you know, what is the thing that just keeps drawing me, and at the same time, I can never quite grasp it. And it seems to me that other people can. And I think there are the people who can rest much better than I can, right?
Yeah.
But they're not really the teachers of rest.
Right.
Now, it's not so much that it's my word to teach in any kind of formal way. It is, though, to the degree that I can embody that I can get it for myself, it has to be such a thing of consciousness that I then, from that place, I can offer whatever is needed in an instance with somebody else much better when I'm in touch with that. So in my own journey to try and develop my ability to embody that word rest, to the degree I'm able to do that with some consciousness, when I work with somebody else, I'll be able to intuit what it is they need right now and what might be the best thing to do or say or how to be with them. So it's like my little challenge that lets me know how far off I am, how far on I am, you know? If I'm a long way away, I can feel it. And of course, in some ways, the chronic fatigue fine-tunes that because I can feel the lack of rest even just a little bit at a really sort of finely tuned level, sadly.
Well, all of your books are amazing. What is next for Araya?
Well, I'm working on fiction, which I've discovered is much more work than I thought it was. My hat's off. I've for years loved reading fictions and have always revered novelists, but I have to say I have a whole new respect for them, really. So I'm working on a piece of fiction, and I've been, you know, doing a weekly blog, and I know in that are lots of the ends of threads of what will be the new nonfiction, which is really mostly about the working title, which I haven't actually said publicly yet, is Diaries of a Reluctant Human. Because I think, you know, I hear enormous amount about we have to be in the now. It's become a very popular thing, and I would not refute that, except the catch, and there's always a catch, is that to be in the now, you have to be here. Which means in this body, not the one you had 20 years ago or the one you might have someday if you ever eat the way you know you should and exercise as much as you want to. In this world, not the one we might be able to create someday, you know. This is the catch, is that there's no way to be in the now without really being here. In whatever's going on in your body and your mind and your heart, whatever's going on in the world around you and then the larger world beyond that. That's the only... And you can see just in that why we might be a little reluctant.
Yes, because we have to accept it.
Yeah. 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 So that's kind of the nonfiction thread that I'm kind of working on in the side. But for me, the focus and the challenge is really with the fiction, because I think story is still what moves and touches us most deeply on levels beyond the conscious mind, in writing it or reading it, you know? And so my challenge when I write fiction, as my son reminds me repeatedly, is to stay out of the way. You know, he said to me, because the story focuses around a dreamer's wheel, and it's something that I participated on, a group of people who work in the lucid dream state to create change in the fifth dimension or a dream that will come into the third dimension. But of course, because I worked in it, there's all kinds of teachings. And he said, now, don't get attached to getting the teachings all in there and screw up the story, which is entirely possible. I might add. So letting the story tell itself through me more.
Right. Know. That's interesting. I imagine it will be amazing. So you have a blog which is separate from your website. So tell both of how people
yes.
can get
on. So the website is at oriah.org, oriah.org. And there are links there to both the Facebook page where I post most days. And I post the weekly blog up on the Facebook page for Oriah Mountain Dreamer in the notes, but it's also on oriahsinvitation.blogspot.com.
Nice.
And the links to that are on the website.
Okay, perfect. Well, I would love to have you come back.
Oh, it would be my pleasure.
Oh, great. Yay. This has been a lot of fun. Thank you very much for gracing us tonight.
Thank you.
It was fun.